From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Berlin, Ankara, and the Political Consequences. I'm Barbara Bogave, sitting in for Warren Olney, and this is To the Point. A truck rammed into holiday revelers celebrating at a Christmas market in Berlin, killing 12 and wounding scores more. A lone gunman assassinated Russia's ambassador to Turkey and wounded three others in a shocking public display at an Ankara photo exhibit. Both events are being investigated as acts of terrorism. Whatever the exact cause, the perception of escalating violence could have far-reaching effects on Europe's policy on immigration, refugees, and the war in Syria. The latest on the holiday attacks yesterday and their political fallout coming up. And on today's Talking Point, the nation's lead problem goes way beyond Flint, Michigan. A new investigation shows thousands of neighborhoods with even higher levels. First, the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
This is To the Point. Nice to have you with us. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Warren Olney. Just ahead, we'll follow up on yesterday's deadly attacks in Germany and Turkey, the latest on the investigations and their political fallout. And on today's Talking Point, four more Flint, Michigan officials face charges today in the city's polluted water crisis. But a new Reuters investigation has found much higher lead levels in thousands of places across the country. Is anything being done beyond Flint? First, this news update. North Carolina's outgoing Republican Governor Pat McCrory has called for a special session tomorrow to consider repealing HB 2, the controversial law curbing legal protections for LGBTQ people, commonly known as the bathroom bill. This comes after the Charlotte City Council rescinded a local anti-discrimination ordinance on Monday, just another twist in the jockeying over the issue since the statewide law was passed last March. Colin Campbell is state politics reporter, for the News and Observer, and he joins us from Raleigh. Good, nice to have you with us.
Hi, Barbara. Thanks for having me.
So remind us what this city ordinance enforced originally and why the city council decided to repeal it on Monday.
So the Charlotte City Council's ordinance was passed back last spring and does a number of sort of non-discrimination sort of provisions, but the most controversial involved bathrooms, and it required that public buildings as well as public restrooms and private businesses allow a transgender person to bathroom that corresponds to their gender identity. That created a pretty big backlash from Republicans, particularly conservative religious groups, and that caused the push for House Bill 2 at the state level. Now, the Charlotte City Council had been offered several times to repeal its ordinance, and in exchange, the state would repeal House Bill 2. They have several times over the past year declined to do so, and so this deal this week came as kind of a big surprise. There was no real advance notice. Charlotte City Council was going to take the vote on Monday morning, and no real knowledge that a deal was in the works and that we could have this bill repealed by the end of the week.
It's such a complicated tale, and we're having a little trouble hearing you, so we're going to take a moment and try and call you back on a better line. But it is curious that now we have, you know, outgoing Governor Pat McCrory calling a special session for tomorrow to repeal HB 2, this very piece of legislation, as you write, that he fought so hard to pass. So let's see if we have you back, and we're going to talk about what his motivation is and what the political wrangling is behind us, and also remind everyone of all of the people who have jumped in on this issue. They range from everyone from Bruce Springsteen to the NBA. And I understand, Colin Campbell, we have you back. On the line? Okay, let's see if we can hear you now. I was just murmuring on about how complicated this is, and the fact that here we have a governor calling a special session for to repeal the very piece of legislation that he fought desperately to pass. So what's going on there?
Yeah, you know, it's Pat McCrory is almost his last week or two as governor. This deal was apparently brokered by the governor-elect, Democrat Roy Cooper, who campaigned very strongly against House Bill 2 and had apparently been lobbying the Charlotte City Council to support this new deal. For Governor McCrory, my guess is that he's following through the promise he's made all along that House Bill 2 was required because of what Charlotte did, and if Charlotte backed down, then the state would back down. It'll also help Governor McCrory's legacy in that we won't necessarily see more economic backlash that can be attributed to his time in office, even after he's gone.
And take us back. Who has just thrown their weight behind protesting this bathroom bill? What's it cost North Carolina in these 9 months?
Millions of dollars, a number of sporting events, including the NBA All-Star Game, a number of NCAA tournaments that have been moved to other states as a result of this law, several companies, most notably PayPal, dropping job expansion, and a number of conferences taking out. So the economic pressure has been huge, and a lot of it's been put on by a national LGBT advocacy group, Human Rights Campaign, which has sort of encouraged some of these acts of protest from companies that have pulled out of North Carolina.
Yeah, and what reaction are you seeing so far in North Carolina? Are there family values organizations upset by this possible repeal?
Yeah, so a lot of these conservative evangelical groups that lobbied for House Bill 2 in the first place are now lobbying legislators to hold firm and refuse to repeal the law. They say it's a good law, and regardless of what Charlotte does, it should stay on the books. And then on the other side, we have folks on the left, LGBT folks who think that this is a bad compromise. The Charlotte City Council, they say, has sold out LGBT rights in order to make this change, and they're unhappy with what's going on. So a lot of backlash, and a lot of people who are excited to see it taken off the books.
And is it a done deal that it will be repealed?
Well, the leaders of the legislature on the Republican side have both committed that they are supportive of the repeal. So has the governor. The question is whether they have enough votes, whether some Republicans may bow to the pressure from the conservative groups that don't want to see it repealed, and whether some Democrats may not like any possible strings that are attached to repeal, and we don't know if there will be any. So it's certainly not a done deal, and it's possible some folks in both parties could defect when this comes into a vote in the legislature tomorrow.
Right. Nothing a done deal here in North Carolina. Colin Campbell with the News and Observer, thank you very much for this.
Thanks a lot.
When we come back, the truck attack in Germany, an assassination in Turkey. We get an update on the wave of violence yesterday and its potential fallout. Stay with us for that conversation on To the Point from PRI.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
We're back with To the Point. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Warren Olney. When a lone gunman assassinated Russia's ambassador to Turkey in a shocking public display at Ankara photo exhibit yesterday, the international consequences were immediate. Hours later, a tractor-trailer truck mowed down holiday revelers celebrating at a Christmas market in Berlin, killing 12 and wounding scores more. Germany, as we're about to hear, has been preparing for terror attacks like the ones that have struck in Paris and Belgium. While authorities are treating these isolated incidents as the work of terrorists, motives and details are still very unclear. We're going to get updates now and look at the ripple effects this spate of holiday violence could have far beyond Berlin and Ankara. Paul Hakanos is a Berlin-based writer. His latest book, Berlin Calling, A Story of Anarchy, Loud Music, The Wall, and the Birth of the New Berlin, is due out in 2017. And it's very good of you to join us this morning.
Thank you very much.
So first, let's just start with the mood in Berlin there today. Is there a heightened sense of tension or security or back to normal?
Well, I mean, people are stunned and shocked and unnerved as well. But they've really been kind of going about the daily life, including the Christmas preparations, more or less as usual, if a bit more subdued and rueful. I took my son to the kindergarten this morning, and they had 20 kids lining up to take them out to a Christmas film. And so it wasn't that everything was off for the day. Things were going about pretty much as normal. The Germans haven't been overreacting, and this hasn't happened in Berlin either. It is the case that all of the Christmas markets are closed today, and then when they reopen, presumably tomorrow, will be the case, there'll be more police and they'll be wearing bulletproof vests. So that's about all the extra security measures that have been announced so far. I mean, we have to remember, it's still far from clear exactly what happened. And as far as we know, the perpetrator is still on the loose.
Well, exactly. So, and give us an update on that, because so much is unknown. There were two men apparently were in the truck. One was dead at the scene, and police had a suspected driver in custody. But they're now saying they've released him, and they're saying he's likely not the right man. So what do we know now?
He's definitely not. They arrested a Pakistani man, 32 years old, who did indeed come into the country in February 2015 as a refugee and has refugee status now, and he has been released. So the officials are saying that they, at the moment, they're not giving any more information other than the fact that the perpetrator or perpetrators are on the loose. That's all they know. They're not saying anything more.
And the passenger? Was found dead.
The passenger was a Polish driver and owner of the truck, or employee of the trucking firm, and he was shot dead in the passenger seat.
And that's been established. Now, how is Chancellor Angela Merkel reacting?
Well, in her usual stoic, even-handed, level-headed manner, and she addressed the nation on two occasions today. She was expressed grief and sorrow, what you would expect. These kind of emotional things, really aren't her forte, but she struck the right chord. She also said very clearly that, we cannot let this fear get the better of us and our society. She also underlined that we can't equate, the refugees among us who have been fleeing Islamic fundamentalism and being protected by Germany to confuse with those people who are the perpetrators of religious violence of one kind or another. But it's going to be a very fine line that she has to walk, because she is symbolic. She's the person most in all of Europe most associated with an open refugee policy. And this isn't the first time. This is the first time that Berlin has been hit. But as you mentioned, other cities in Europe have been for many years, and in Germany as well, there have been attacks, and some have been successful. I mean, recently a migrant murdered a student in the town of Freiburg in southern Germany. And other attempts have been thwarted. But Merkel has to do a number of things at once. She has to make sure that Germans feel that they're secure. She has to address the grieving and the mourning that's going on. And at the same time, she has to basically, defend her refugee policy. It's actually, the policies of political asylum, they're not just Germans. They're also the EU and international as well. She has, however, been the foremost spokesperson of them and representative of these policies. So she's in a particularly tough situation, also considering that 2017 is an election year. There's a far-right party that has established itself in Germany. Even members of her own Christian Democrats are very critical of the way that she's dealt with migration and refugee policy. So she has her work cut out for her, and it's going to be very interesting to see how she reacts in the coming week.
And before I let you go, because so much is in flux, but this did happen in a very specific place and in Berlin, which is so famously full of life and a liberal heart of culture in Germany. And this target in Berlin, the Christmas market in front of Kaiser Wilhelm Memorial Church, is also symbolic.
Well, certainly. I mean, the fact that such a emblem of Christianity was picked, and these Christmas markets are, they're kind of like mini German utopias, full of actually a lot of kitsch, but there's something that Germans associate very much with Christmas, going to the Christmas markets, and I think it was pretty obvious that this was a symbol, and the idea is to underline the opposition of Islam and Christianity, as well as the fact. I mean, I'm not sure that the perpetrator picked out this one square, which is right at the foot of the Kaiser Wilhelm Church. But I mean, that's a ruin that's been left a ruin since the World War to remind Germans of the war. And I mean, if any place represents the two lines that are kind of inscribed in the German Federal Republic, never again war, never again fascism, is embodied in this church and had always been a symbol of anti-war and anti-violence. And so the fact that they're to see these see corpses and blood laid out at the base of this church, which is such a strong German symbol as well, and it was really quite daunting, I think, for everybody in Germans. And really, it was an ominous image.
Well, to get a sense of how terrorism officials are thinking about yesterday's incident, let's move on and turn to Daniel Benjamin. He was ambassador at large and coordinator for counterterrorism at the U.S. State Department during the first term of the Obama administration. And he's now director at the Dickey Center for International Understanding at Dartmouth College. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So as we keep saying, much is unknown, but from the facts that we do have, is there indication that any of this was a coordinated attack?
Well, Chancellor Merkel has said that she believes it's terrorism. Witnesses said that they didn't see any evidence that the truck was trying to slow down or to avert the Christmas market. And the likeness to the Nice attack, the fact that someone was, you know, that there was a corpse in the front seat, I think it's all pretty clear that something was going badly wrong.
You're referring to the another truck attack in the summer.
Correct.
Nice during Bastille Day celebrations.
Right. Correct.
And how do terrorism officials think about the fact that no one has claimed responsibility?
Well, claims of responsibility have become pretty rare. That in itself is not surprising. And the chances are, at least judging by the volume of terrorist attacks we see in Europe, that it might have been done by homegrown extremists who didn't have a particular affiliation with any particular group. So it could have been someone, you know, fulfilling their own desire to carry out an attack, make a mark, create a bit of history without it having to be organized by an organization. The fact that the driver was killed is, a new development. I don't think we've seen that. At least I can't recall any cases like that. And the fact that there was a firearm available, which there aren't that many, in Europe. I mean, there are many more than there once were because of the various wars nearby, but that does add some possibility of coordination, a larger organization behind it, but it's really too early to say.
So getting back to the fact that this recalls that deadly truck attack in Nice, remind us, how did France change security after that attack, and is Germany likely to follow their example? And what is the fact that one of the perpetrators seemingly is on the loose now in Berlin say about the state of security in Germany?
Well, it's certainly disquieting that the apparent perpetrator is on the run. France, did the best it could in terms of dealing with, a country full of soft targets. It is very hard to protect against people who want to drive vehicles up onto sidewalks, into crowded parks, things like that. I think that they did take some measures for some time, but it's not something that you can keep up forever. The French have been increasing their funding for intelligence and police operations. But like countries throughout Europe, this is going to be a long period of upgrading security for them because they did not have the kind of organizing event that we did on 9/11, and therefore their spending levels have tended to be considerably lower, and that's true in much of Europe.
So, what does that mean to up security? What are terrorism officials in Europe doing right or wrong, or specifically in Germany?
Well, of course, what they're doing right is shutting down all the Christmas markets for now, because those are obviously soft targets, and when you have an event like this, you have a considerable fear of copycat attacks, and the fact that the perpetrator himself is still on the loose, adds another element of danger to it. So, limiting the number of large crowded spaces with innocent people milling about makes a lot of sense. I'm sure that they are out turning over every rock they can and checking with checking on established networks of extremists and people who they've had under surveillance, whether continuous or intermittent, to see if there's any indication that they were involved. But this is going to be a tough one, I'm afraid.
Let's bring Derek Chollet in. He's a senior advisor for security and defense policy at the German Marshall Fund, and he's also the author of The Long Game, How Obama Defied Washington and Redefined America's Role in the World. And he served in the Obama administration as a U.S. Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs. Good to have you join us.
Thanks for having me.
So what do you anticipate or how do you anticipate this might change the openness that we have experienced in Europe over the last couple of decades? More border controls immediately in the process?
Yes. And I mean, we've seen the openness that Chancellor Merkel displayed last year when the Syrian refugee crisis peaked has ended over the course of this year, and the refugee flows into Germany specifically have tapered off significantly. I think clearly, as has been mentioned earlier, this is going to affect the upcoming presidential campaign in Germany, which will be in September of this year, particularly if the perpetrator of this attack was in fact a refugee. That will ignite the passions of those who are calling or criticizing the chancellor for her past openness and calling for a crackdown on that population. So although there's still a lot we do not know about what's happened here, I think this will certainly heighten the tensions inside Germany and the debate about what Germany's done in the past in terms of its openness, but also what it should be doing in the future.
And what about taking the lead, as Germany has, in accepting Syrian refugees into the country, into Europe?
Well, I think this will, again, as this upcoming election is a referendum on Chancellor Merkel's leadership, to the extent that there are those in the German political system saying that leadership has brought consequences like this. And again, we can't prove that based on what we know, but certainly her political opponents will try to use this attack against her. And I can't help to think that this will have a lasting effect on the campaign. And unfortunately, as we've seen these attacks throughout Germany more frequently in the last 6 months, this is the first in Berlin, but there's been others in the last several months in Munich, Freiburg, as has been noting earlier. I think we have to expect more of this in the future, which for Germany brings a lot of difficult questions about the role of its security services, the role of its intelligence services domestically, and whether Germany at one point will have to take a measure that, for example, France took in the wake of the terrorist attacks there and deployed their military to help with homeland security.
Well, how controversial or how heated is the debate over surveillance versus privacy in Germany right now? How are German voters weighing these things?
Well, this is an issue that goes to the heart of Germany's anxieties about its history, whether that's the history of East Germany or history, of course, coming out of the Nazi era, where state control, state surveillance was a critical part of those regimes' ability to coerce significant parts of the population. So this is a very difficult balancing act in any democracy between privacy and liberty and security, and particularly so in a country whose history is as difficult as Germany's.
And we'll talk more about that in the second half of the show. Derek Chollet with the German Marshall Fund. Let's take that break now, and we're going to talk about yesterday's wave of violence more in a moment. And later on To the Point, more officials face criminal charges today in the water crisis in Flint, Michigan. But a new investigation has found thousands of other neighborhoods across the country where lead levels are high. Stay with us. This is To the Point. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Warren Olney. And back now to our conversation about two deadly attacks yesterday. We heard earlier how Berlin is responding after a semi-rig plowed into holiday crowds at a Christmas market, and hours before a gunman killed Russia's ambassador to Turkey and wounded three others at an art center in Ankara. Minutes later, a man tried to shoot his way into the American embassy in Ankara. The embassy had sponsored the photography exhibit where the Russian ambassador was gunned down. So a number of incidents. And while they they don't appear to be connected, they highlight the growing security challenge for Europe and complicate international response to, for instance, the war in Syria. Emily Tamkin is a staff writer for Foreign Policy. She wrote a piece yesterday about five things to worry about after the assassination of the Russian ambassador in Turkey. Welcome to The Point.
Thank you very much.
Well, first on your list was Russian cyberbullying. And tell us more about an anticipated Russian response to this killing of their ambassador and why that might come into play.
Of course. So the point of our piece was to say this is not the Franz Ferdinand moment of 2016. This is likely not the beginning of World War III. If Russia is to respond, here are some things it can do based on things that it has done. So earlier this month, WikiLeaks leaked thousands of emails related to Erdogan's son-in-law, who's also their Minister of Natural Resources. So one mode of recourse that Russia might have is cyber and hacking. Other options that we laid out, economic sanctions, as it put in place after Turkey shot down a Russian plane in November 2015.
Right. They put the Turkish gas pipeline on hold, right?
Exactly. And relations hadn't warmed until Erdogan apologized in June and then cracked down on his own society after the coup in July. We also said, you know, perhaps we would see the fragile ceasefire for evacuation in Aleppo fall apart and see the situation in Syria worsen further still. The option that seems most likely to play out now that Russia and Turkey have both released their statements is that both governments will crack down on their own civil societies, right? So both have sort of reaffirmed their commitment to fighting terrorism. From Turkey's perspective, that seems to be Gulenists, so followers of exiled Muslim cleric Fethullah Gulen. And in Russia, that's, I don't particularly care for this phrase, but Islamic terrorists, particularly given that this follows a weekend of fighting in Chechnya.
And what do you take from the fact that this trilateral agreement on the Syrian ceasefire and dealing with the war in Syria, that the talks between Iran and Russia and Turkey are going on despite this upheaval? Does that rule out some of your potential fallout?
Yes, I mean, It would certainly seem that in the short term, Russia is not looking to retaliate against Turkey. I would imagine that Turkey is now more willing to sort of play by Russia's rules than perhaps it was, maybe accepting more of a junior partnership role in this agreement. But the party to whom Russia and Turkey have sort of pointed is not Turkey or Russia, but the United States. So today, Turkish publications and politicians, or Turkish and Russian publications and politicians, have come forward and said, and this is different from the official response, but have said, you know, perhaps this was the workings of the United States. Perhaps there was a parliamentarian who said that, you know, this was a move to sort of draw Turkey further into NATO's fold and to weaken the newfound friendship between Turkey and Russia.
And that's why you wrote today that the U.S. is likely to be the biggest loser in the wake of this assassination of Russia's ambassador.
Exactly, because even though Turkey has been in NATO since 1952, and even though Turkey has invoked not Article 5, but Article 4, which says that sort of all of NATO needs to come together to have a conversation, as recently as last year, I believe, despite that, given the way that the politics are sort of playing out now, it would seem that Russia and Turkey will crack down on their own societies and then become warier still of the United States. Although I should say that this also depends on how U.S. President-elect Trump responds. Thus far, he has called this an incident of Islamic terrorism, which seems to be echoing the Russian line.
That's very complicated, and there's also the issue of posturing. Well, let's hear more about how these violent incidents are playing out in Turkey. Henri Barki is director of the Middle East Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars, and it's good to talk with you again.
Thank you for having me.
Stepping back and getting to the facts of this event in Ankara, this assassination of the ambassador, it was such a shocking few moments. The images of the shooter and that it was so, the public nature of it and the rarity of an assassination like this. I'm curious what your first impression was of what was at play in this violence.
Well, I mean, when you watch the event, I mean, the shooter kind of hovers around the ambassador behind, and he looks very nervous. He's pacing. He's looking at the wall. He looks at the ceiling. You can see that he's trying to make up his mind whether or not he should go ahead with what he had decided to do. And then at some point, he takes his revolver out and starts shooting. So first of all, yeah, he was a police officer who went in without being checked. He showed his badge and he walked through. And the rest of the security services should have realized that this guy should not have been behind the ambassador. I mean, it was a major failure of the whoever was protecting the ambassador, both Russian and Turkish officials. So, I mean, there is a lot to be answered for what happened yesterday by these officials. But look, the implications of this, I mean, the Turks are already blaming the Fethullah Gülen organization. This has all the earmarks of a lone terrorist who's doing this, who's clearly, he's not a professional. After he shoots the ambassador, he kind of challenges everybody. He calls out for al-Nusra. So it seems to me that, you know, he wanted either to be killed or be captured. He wasn't trying to run away. But the problem for the Turks is that they are intent on blaming the Fethullah Gülen organization, and this looks a little bit ridiculous because less than 24 hours after the event, they automatically blamed the Gülen organization. And you have to remember, when they shot down the Russian plane in November of 2015, they were initially very proud. They said, we shot it down, we gave the order, and if it happens again, we'll give the order. And then when the Russians slapped sanctions on them, they changed their tune some 6 months later, as you heard earlier, and suddenly they said, oh, it was Gülen pilots. I mean, so they invent these stories which make them look not very credible, to put it mildly.
But what do you think the fallout of that will be? Because as our guest Emily Tamkin just said, one would expect that Erdogan would continue to crack down on civil liberties. He's already detained thousands after the coup attempt in July.
I mean, he was going to do that irrespective of the assassination attempt. I mean, every day more professors, more journalists, more academics, etc., are being detained. But I would say, I would add another aspect to all this. Part of the deal between Russia, Iran, and Turkey has to do with the fact that once Aleppo fell, there was nothing the Turks could do. So what the Turks are looking for now is a carte blanche from the Russians to attack the Syrian Kurds, because the Turkish focus changed in the last 6 months to a year from the jihadists in Aleppo or the resistance against Assad to the Syrian Kurds. Today, the Syrian Kurds are far more important, a challenger and a target for the Turks than the Syrian regime. So they've made their peace with Assad staying in power. They made their peace with the fact that they've lost in Aleppo. And now what they really want to do is take on the Syrian Kurds. The problem here is that the Syrian Kurds are being backed by the United States, because we are using the Syrian Kurds to go after ISIS. So that makes it all the more complicated, because now it is possible that we're going to see a major clash between Turkey, United States over this. And if I was the Turks, I would do something on the 18th of January, 2 days before the transition, because Obama won't be able to respond, and Trump administration will be not ready to confront these threats. I mean, we are in a very dangerous and very unpredictable situation.
Emily Tamkin with Foreign Policy, weigh in on this. Do you agree with that assessment?
I certainly do. I think that right now, Turkey and Russia sort of are of one mind on what needs to be accomplished in Syria. So Russia has agreed to stop the Syrian Kurds, to the best of my knowledge, from having contiguous territory, whereas the United States, as your other guest just said, supports the Syrian Kurds. So that's a point of contention between the U.S. and Turkey, as is Gülen, and both of those are sort of at the forefront after this incident.
And Derek Chollet, let's bring you back into the conversation. You're with the German Marshall Fund. How do you see this playing out, this jockeying?
Well, I agree very much with what's been said in terms of the enormously complicated situation inside Syria, with Syria and Russia coming closer together. against the United States. There's a practical issue the Obama administration has been facing and that the Trump administration will face, is that the Syrian Kurds have proven the most effective fighters on the ground. And one of the questions that a new administration will face when it comes to retaking the Syrian city of Raqqa, which, presuming that Mosul and Iraq falls, will be the last major ISIS stronghold, will be if it chooses to do that soon, it wants to do it quickly, it will have to do it with the Syrian Kurds because that's the most capable. If it wants to wait and try to get the Arab tribes more capable, then it will take more time. The big question, I think, for all of us to watch is the incoming Trump administration on both of the issues related to what seems to have, at least around this incident in Turkey, the assassination of the ambassador, the Gülen role, which, of course, the Erdogan regime is purporting that there's the Gülenists are behind this. Some around the president-elect have suggested a sympathetic perspective, at least with Erdogan, in terms of the Gülenists, whereas the Obama administration has been trying to kind of play this straight. There's some around the president-elect who take Erdogan's side at this. And then also the role of Russia in Syria, where one of the big questions for a new team will be what degree of cooperation they're going to be seeking with Russia in Syria. It could be that they seek to take Putin's side in Syria.
And what do you expect Washington's response will be in January? Are we bracing ourselves for more attacks?
Well, I mean, I think it is entirely plausible, as Henri Barkey said, to expect some surprise move in the run up to the inauguration, a January surprise, so to speak. But I think the big question for us is how any administration would be challenged by the kind of surprise. But a Trump administration that would come in with potentially a different view on Russia's role in the Syria conflict and a different view of the Gülen situation inside Turkey will mean a very, very different U.S. policy.
I'd like to throw this back to you, Henri Barkey, with the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. How do you foresee potential January surprises?
Well, I mean, as I said earlier, this is what I fear the most because, let's face it, the Trump administration will come, but it will not have any of its main players in place confirmed yet. So you will see a situation where there will be policy confusion. Any administration that comes in, but especially the Trump administration, which hasn't so far shown a great deal of, shall we say, coherence on when it comes to foreign policy. We've heard that Mr. Trump is very pro-Russian, or he sees the Russians as potential allies. But we really don't know what kind of position he will take. But the fact of the matter is that on the Gülen issue, the Trump administration, I don't think, will be able to do anything much because Mr. Gülen has a green card and the judicial process will have to take its course, and that may take months, if not years. So will he be forced or wanting to make a concession to the Turks by abandoning the Syrian Kurds because he can't do anything on Mr. Gülen? So everybody's going to be bargaining here, but clearly, at some level, the American position has been weakened, but I also think that the position of the Turks have been weakened with respect to the Russians. I mean, the Russians are in the driver's seat, and they will be able to exact whatever price they want from the Turks. I mean, this is first it was the Russian airplane, now it's the Russian ambassador, and the Turks find themselves in a very difficult position. If the Turks can get something out of the Russians on the Syrian Kurds, they'll be very happy because that's their priority. And that's why I think that something will happen with respect to Syrian Kurds. There are already Turkish troops in Syria, and there are lots and lots of Turkish troops across the border waiting to go in. So that, to me, is the most likely scenario at this stage. But it is also a scenario, by the way, that the Turks should take seriously, because if they were to take on the Syrian Kurds are not going to be walked over. I mean, this is a serious force, and the Turks will take a huge number of casualties. And how will that play in Turkey is also another factor, because Mr. Erdogan is trying to change the constitution to introduce a presidential system that is not exactly very popular in Turkey at the moment. So, I mean, this is a really a multi-level chess game, and I think it's very, very unpredictable, which makes it, well, I guess, interesting, but also very dangerous.
And Derek Schley, turning back to you on NATO, how does this complicate the Russian-NATO relationship?
Well, not directly, but certainly indirectly. Turkey, as has been noted earlier, longstanding member of NATO, but an incredibly complicated member of NATO. And one of the things that folks have been watching very closely is the degree to which Turkey and Russia's relationship has been warming, and if Turkey, that relationship were to warm in a way that Turkey starts to play more of a spoiler role within the alliance, that's something we haven't seen indications of yet, but if one just were to play this out to its logical conclusion, it certainly would further weaken the solidarity within NATO that is already going to be a little fragile with the new administration taking office, with the president-elect who's openly questioned the value of NATO.
Well, let's leave it there. I want to thank all of you for a great conversation. Thanks so much. Derek Schley with the German Marshall Fund, Emily Tamkin with Foreign Policy, Berlin-based writer earlier in the hour, Paul Hakanos, Henri Barkey at the Woodrow Wilson International Center, and earlier we also heard from Dartmouth University's Daniel Benjamin. Thank you again. And stay with us. Just ahead, the nation's lead problem, it goes way beyond Flint, Michigan, unfortunately. A new investigation shows thousands of neighborhoods with even higher levels of lead. Back in a moment with that on today's Talking Point.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Barbara Bogave and for Warren Olney here with today's Talking Point. Four former city officials in Flint, Michigan are facing criminal charges today over the city's water crisis, which exposed residents to dangerous levels of lead. That brings the total to 13 brought up on criminal charges in the scandal. Flint has stayed in the headlines, but it isn't the only American community with a lead problem. According to a new investigation by Reuters, Flint doesn't even rank in the top 10. Reporters found nearly 3,000 communities with recently recorded lead poisoning rates, at least double those in Flint, and more than 1,000 of those places had rates four times as high. Michael Pell is a data journalist for Reuters, and he co-authored this story. It's good to talk with you on To the Point.
Thanks for having me, Barbara.
So 3,000 areas with higher lead levels than Flint. Where are the most contaminated places, and just how much worse is the situation?
Sure. Well, it's hard to say exactly, you know, who's worse, you know, but with absolute precision. But what we can say is that there are neighborhoods in Cleveland, Baltimore, Philadelphia, Milwaukee, even small towns that I visited like St. Joseph, Missouri, that have much higher rates of tested children with elevated lead levels.
And what's the common thread or common threads? Is this poor communities and states with older housing stock?
That is certainly a problem. Poor communities with older housing stock, whether it be from the lead paint, whether it be from the soil around the yard, or whether it be from the pipes, the lead pipes in the home, that's definitely a problem. But what we found is that it extends beyond that. We identified a community in Missouri, Viburnum, Missouri, that does not have a tremendous amount of old housing. It does not have a tremendous amount of poverty when compared with some of the other communities when we looked at. And so in a lot of ways, it's not a community that you would predict to have a problem with lead poisoning. But there's an active lead mine there.
Ah, okay.
It has a long history of lead mining.
And so Superfund sites and industrial waste, those are a factor as well.
Absolutely. This community has two Superfund sites in and around it. We identified other areas that have Superfund sites. Yes. And it's not just that, too. We talk to people that run the gamut, rich and poor. We spoke with a pediatrician in St. Joseph, Missouri, who works with these kids that have lead poisoning. And two of her children tested high. One of them was very high. And she lives in an older house, a house that had been painted God knows how many times, with lead paint over the course of probably about 100 years.
And it is children most affected, right? And how are they affected? Because these elevated levels, they can really seriously impact kids' health. You tell the story of Brandon in Milwaukee.
I think that Brandon is a good example. My partner Josh sat down with him and his mother just a few weeks ago, and Brandon still, he was poisoned many years ago, and he still has problems. And what Brandon told us was that he thinks, if not for the poisoning, if not for the lead paint in the rental property that he lived in as a young child, he wouldn't have some of the cognitive difficulties that he has. He wouldn't have the problems regulating his emotions, life would have been very different for him.
Right. And Freddie Gray, the Baltimore man who died in a police van last year, he was another lead poisoning victim as a child, right?
Absolutely. He was, and this is kind of one of the penultimate examples. And what we found was that Freddie Gray's, the neighborhoods around where Freddie Gray grew up, have extremely high rates of kids with high lead levels.
Okay, so health departments are tracking this, though. This is where you're gathering your data, besides the visits that you actually made to so many of these neighborhoods, and public officials know about it. So why is lead still such a problem?
Well, so, I mean, we did obtain data from many states, testing data, although some of the states prepared this data especially for us. Other states said, Mike, we don't have it. This isn't something we look at, and we're not going to do it. So, you know, while some states really are on top of this, others are not. There's also, you know, once I was just talking to a state epidemiologist who was very interested in this, and he was telling me that, you know, one, you can do the testing, but if you don't have a plan to remediate the problem, then it's just going to continue. And so there is, in many ways, a lack of public will to spend the money to address this problem, even though we know that, you know, for every dollar that's spent preventing this problem, there is a return in lower school costs and other social costs. I mean, we don't necessarily, that's what the best research suggests.
Well, Congress gave Flint, what, $170 million for remediation? So what does it take to free up funds to clean up these neighborhoods?
Well, that's why we did the story, was to show, if, you know, the people that were outraged about Flint, there's plenty more to be outraged about. And when this outrage factor did capture the American imagination, Congress did appropriate $170 million for the people of Flint. And I'm not suggesting that it's inappropriate at all. I'm very happy that their issues are going to be taken care of. But the CDC's total budget for assisting states with lead is $17 million for this year.
So a drop in the bucket.
Right. So Flint gets $170 million and the rest of the country shares 17.
Well, what response have you gotten to your investigation?
We've gotten a lot of response from epidemiologists, from the public, generally very positive. It seems like a lot of people have had these kinds of problems, and I think that they like to know that there's even if they've had these problems, they don't know what it looks like. And so when you see this, you can picture the communities that are suffering the most, and what some nonprofit organizations and epidemiologists are telling us is that they'd like to use this data to identify where they can get sort of the most bang for their buck.
Well, we have 13 officials in Michigan facing criminal charges in that water crisis, and that of course is its own mess, tangled web. But is that perhaps what it takes? Are there people pursuing this in the courts through lawsuits to clean up lead?
There are definitely many lawsuits across the country involving lead. I don't know. I think it takes public will to say that we as a country, as a community, as a town, as a county, as a state, are going to pay to remediate properties, and also to make sure that property owners like landlords, do remediate risk.
As I said, and you said, you actually went and did the legwork in these communities to investigate this. Why did you do that and not just rely on data and phone calling?
Because the data can only tell so much of the story. And you can look at numbers and say, okay, you know, this is a problem across the country. But when I was in St. Joseph, Missouri, and talking to a mother whose child just last year had lead levels that were so high that he nearly needed to be hospitalized, that puts it in perspective, and that shows why this is so important.
So are you hopeful that there will be some relief for these people, these families, these kids in these neighborhoods? And are adults affected as well?
Yes, adults definitely can be affected as well. As a matter of fact, we did speak with an adult that had high lead levels. It can affect your kidneys. It can affect your brain. It can affect your nervous system. So it's not just kids. It's just that kids whose brains are developing are at a much higher risk with even a much lower dose.
Michael Pell, he's a data journalist for Reuters and co-authored the story, The Investigation into Lead Poisoning Across the Country. I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
And thanks for your work. I'm Barbara Bogave, and for Warren Olney, that'll do it for us for today. You can join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW, Santa Monica, and Public Radio International.
Public Radio International.